I think I realized the future that many of us thought was coming was dead when I was looking at a picture of a 1970s airport lounge. Interestingly, it looked more advanced than my actual living room. And I was thinking about Terrence McKenna the other day and how he used to talk about time speeding up. So he had this idea that we're approaching something like a singularity where everything eventually happens or ends up happening all at once. And in a way, he was right because, well, I mean, just look what's happening. I mean, we might as well be strapped to the front of a runaway tech train. However, I don't think those two things are necessarily mutually exclusive. I mean, yeah, we're moving forward at breakneck speed, but we're also being increasingly haunted by a version of tomorrow that never materialized. It never showed up to the party that we had planned for it. So, we're essentially living in a high-speed chase where we're running away from the present and toward a ghost. I don't know. I mean, maybe the future was an actual place we were supposed to travel toward, and it had a specific smell. It was somehow tangible. And we thought we were going to get a clean break from the past. You've heard it before. The city is under the domes, sleek modernism. Maybe we'd get those space age jumpsuits that ignored the concept of a waistline. But instead, it's 2026, and the so-called futurism that we inherited looks a lot more, I would say, unsettling. And we basically spend our days being tracked by algorithms that seem to somehow know that you're depressed even before you do. We've got doorbells now that recognize faces and feeds them to a police database. You can look at a screen and watch a deep fake that you're not even sure if it's real or not, of a dead comedian being puppeted by an algorithm while some billionaire tries to put a chip in a human brain so we can sync with the same machines that are making us obsolete. So now we have the technology of a God-tier dystopia, but we have the culture of a 1990s shopping mall. Yeah. And it looks like we are accelerating into this bizarre world of biometric surveillance and all these generative nightmares, but we're doing it while watching a reboot of a movie that came out when our parents, or at least my parents, were still optimistic. So we're not, I wouldn't say we're progressing. Nonetheless, we are moving faster and faster. And we're just adding more pixels to the same images that we've been staring at for 30 years or so. So the future didn't, well, the future that we were expecting didn't arrive. It just became like a costume that we put on because the present feels too thin to stand on. And there's a word for this feeling. Hauntology. It's being haunted by lost futures. I think it explains why everything feels like some strange rerun, even, you know, even as the world is spinning into a blur. And we're living in this this echo of a scream that happened 40 or 50 years ago. All right. No, it's Mark Fisher. This is the guy I'm thinking of. He's the one who really nailed this concept. So Fisher talked about the slow cancellation of the future. And honestly, I haven't found a better way to put it. I think about the gap of time between, say, 1975 and 2025, and the world changed so fast in that time span, it would have given you whiplash. I mean, let me put it to you this way. If you fell asleep in the 70s and you woke up in 2025, it's highly likely that you'd think you were on an alien planet. But even with all of these massive changes, the vibe and the culture is, in a sense, it's frozen. We're just orbiting the same dead stars. Now, I think Fisher's point was that we're actually haunted by these lost futures. So back in the mid-20th century, there was this collective belief, and a weirdly naive one, maybe, but there was this belief that things would get better, or at the very least, weirder. Now, they did get weirder. And then somewhere around the late 70s, I think the lights started flickering, and we traded those big dreams for lifestyle choices. So basically, we stopped trying to build a new world and settled for buying a new version of the old one. So this brings me to mind the writer Svetlana Boym. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing her name correctly. Svetlana Boym. Now, she had this great idea about restorative nostalgia, which is that dangerous urge to actually try to rebuild the past, to make it great again or whatever. But it's just a delusion. And I think we're stuck in this glitch where we've forgotten how to build a new house. So we just keep dragging a fresh coat of digital paint over the rotting drywall the previous generation left behind. So it's not just nostalgia. It's a funeral for a kid who was never born. And we're addicted to the past because the past is really the only place where the future still felt like a possibility. Even as McKenna's acceleration pushes us towards some digital abyss of AI and biotech, we're still reaching back for the warmth of that world that actually felt real. But I don't think we've quite let that dream go. So I see kids these days, and you know, they weren't even a thought in anyone's head in 1995. And now they're buying vinyl records and shooting on 35 millimeter film. And they seem to be a little obsessed with what they call analog warmth. I remember the analog world all too well. I'd say that term analog warmth is really just a respectful way of saying imperfection. It's the sound of, you know, dust and scratches. And it's the visual of a chemical reaction on a strip of celluloid. And I think, you know, at this point, we're so starved for a sense of real time that we've started fetishizing the glitches of the past. And this involves buying these special plugins for our $3,000 laptops just to make our music sound like it was recorded on a a damp tape deck in a 1980s basement. And I think we do this because the digital present is just, it's just too smooth. It's too clean. It's like a hall of mirrors where everything is perfectly rendered and yet completely soul crushing. I don't think this retro thing is really a fashion choice. I think it's a coping mechanism, because we want to, you know, retreat into the aesthetics of the 80s and or 90s, even though those decades had their own horrors. The difference is that the dystopias back then felt a little more human. I mean, at least in Blade Runner, the rain looked like it could actually wash something away. But, you know, our current dystopia is just a series of agree to terms and conditions pop-ups and, you know, a subscription model for your car's heated seats. And yeah, that's actually a thing. But then I haven't owned a car in 16 years, so I don't know how long that's been around, but it sounds crazy to me. So, Svetlana Boym talked about reflective nostalgia, which is the kind of nostalgia that doesn't try to rebuild the past. It just lingers in this longing for it. So it's a way of saying, look, I know I can't go back, but damn, I miss when things felt solid. And we're in this loop now where we're nostalgic for the nostalgia of 10 years ago. Yeah, that's kind of messed up, because it's like, in a way, it's like eating your own shadow to stay full. I think Mark Fisher was right when he said that, you know, he said that we've traded history for basically a mood board. We're moving toward McKenna singularity at a million miles an hour, but we're doing it with our eyes glued to the rearview mirror. And then you've got the good old algorithm, the great digital priest that tells us what we like before we've even had the chance to get bored. So the algorithm is the ultimate enemy of the future. Why? Because the algorithm is built entirely on the past. It's a mathematical ghost. So it looks at what you clicked on yesterday, and it decides that what you'll see today. And it doesn't want you to be surprised. It doesn't want you to experience what McKenna called a rupture in the fabric of novelty. It wants you to stay in the loop, basically comfortably numb, watching a slightly different version of the same thing forever. Immortality at last. I think this is why every Netflix show starts to look identical these days. It's got that flat, soulless lighting, that pre-approved pacing, you know. And our culture has been automated, and in doing so, we've basically removed the human error that actually creates any progress. And progress usually happens when someone does something wrong, something the data says shouldn't work. But, you know, when the data is more or less running the world, wrong is just a bug that gets patched out at some point. It feels like nothing ever really ends anymore. We're in this permanent meanwhile. You know, in the old world, when a TV show ended, it was gone. That was it. You had to sit with the silence and let it go. You felt the weight of the conclusion. Now, everything's a franchise. Everything has a prequel, a sequel. There's a whole cinematic universe. And you can watch it over and over and over again. So even when a story is clearly dead, we like to dig it up and hook it to a car battery and make it dance for the shareholders now. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm a little tired of watching the Dead dance. Though, one of my favorite bands is called Dead Can Dance. But it's hard to imagine a future when the present refuses to let go of the past's rotting hand. You know, we seem to be stuck in something of a cultural waiting room, reading the same three magazines from 2004, waiting for a doctor who quit his job 30 years ago. Now, I don't want to sound like a grad student here, but I think that you can't really talk about ghosts without talking about the house that they're actually haunting. So I keep hearing that we live in this totally disruptive world of hyper-capitalism. And yeah, that's fairly accurate. But I think the biggest disruption is our ability to focus. And the actual structure of life, that's frozen solid. You know, capitalism used to be all about the new. You know, new markets, new inventions, etc. But then it reached this point where it realized that new is just too risky. But you know what isn't risky? A remake, a sequel. So the system stopped being an engine of progress, and it became what I like to call a ghost machine. It's a giant Xerox machine spitting out faded copies of 1985. It doesn't want to give you a future. It wants to give you a subscription to your own childhood. So utopia has been, at this point, traded for optimization. And we're not asking, well, what kind of world do we want to live in anymore? Now, we're just asking, well, how can I make my current miserable world 5% more efficient? And these days, people are buying things like, you know, productivity planners and smartwatches to track their cortisol levels, as if measuring the ghost will somehow make it leave the room. It's this weirdly polite dystopia full of this endless series of reminders that your cloud storage is full. And, you know, we're haunted by this idea that we're supposed to be going somewhere. But the machine has paved over all the exits and replaced them with digital gift shops. So this is what Fisher called capitalist realism. The sense that there is no other alternative. And when you can't imagine an alternative, you can't really have a future. You just have a now that just gets longer and more desperate until the sun eventually burns out. Now, I think the worst part, it isn't the lack of good movies or the stable music. It's the way that this cultural stagnation, it just kind of leaks into your actual brain. You ever feel that weird objectless anxiety? It's not really about anything specific. It's just this strange feeling like you're waiting for an appointment that you forgot to schedule. I think that's the personal side of this concept of hauntology. I think most of us were raised on a diet of future, where we were told, you know, work hard in school, get a degree, and the world will open up like a blooming flower or something. But the reality is, for most of us, the flower turned out to be plastic, and the degree is just a monthly bill that serves as a reminder that we were basically scammed. I don't think we failed. I think the narrative failed. And we're trying to build a life in a world that's stopped moving forward, even though it's just continuing to spin faster and faster. And it's like trying to run a race on a treadmill that someone unplugged while you were mid-stride. Unfortunately, this creates a specific kind of depression. It's not a sadness. It's like this hollow depression. It's the feeling that the main event already happened. Maybe in the 90s, maybe, I don't know, in the 60s. and you're just staying late to help clean up all the confetti. So we're basically self-improving ourselves to death, trying to fix this software glitch in a world where I'm pretty sure the hardware is just broken. But I don't think we are broken. We're just ghosts in a machine that's run out of new ideas, plain and simple. So in a way, it's like you're mourning a life that you were promised, but never actually given. And I think acknowledging that grief is the only way to stop the haunting. Now, frankly, I think the real horror, it isn't that the world is ending. It's that maybe it's not. At least not in the climactic way we think it will. The cinema conditioned us to expect some big cataclysmic ending. You know, the stereotypical fiery apocalypse or dramatic revolution or something to that effect. Something to provide us with a clean break. A year zero. But the 2020s have shown us that the end of the world is actually just something like a creeping bureaucratic grind. It's just been this bad series of supply chain issues, rising insurance premiums, rent, food, everything else for that matter. And yeah, it's also been the result of the creeping ideological dread that we're seeing. But it all comes accompanied with this weird, permanent sense of deja vu. I think of it as this, as the like the subtle horror of liminal space. You know, those photos of empty malls or deserted office hallways at night. The fluorescent lighting. They feel eerie because they're places of transition that have become permanent. You're not just walking past these places anymore. You're living there. And that's where I think we are. We're in this hallway between a past that's dead and a future that just refuses to be born. And I think the most chilling part about this is how quickly we've just gotten used to it. We've just accepted that our culture is going to be a loop of endless reboots. And our jobs are going to be tasks for an algorithm. If we still have jobs. You know, we're at this point where the ghost is now our roommate. And we're just accepting it. We didn't even try to, you know, exercise it anymore. We just charge it rent and hope it doesn't make too much noise while we're trying to get what little sleep we can. I think we have to stop this hunt for the proverbial big future or whatever you want to call it. And that grand collective destination that the 20th century promised us, that's probably gone. It's a closed chapter. If we want to feel time move again, I think we have to find it in the small, unscalable things, like making something an algorithm would hate. So something messy, inconsistent, preferably deeply local. Lunar craft that takes 10 years and produces zero content. I think the only way to kill a ghost is to stop giving it your attention. I don't know, maybe try doing a feeding the hungry ghost ritual. And ultimately, I think we have to name, we have to put a name on the grief. You aren't actually broken. You're just grieving a world that stopped promising you anything. Personally, I think there's a relief in that. I think there's always a relief in letting go. And, you know, once you realize the future's missing, you get to stop waiting for it to show up and save you. On the other hand, I still think it's entirely possible that the future didn't just completely disappear, completely vanish forever. It just stopped being in our faces. And maybe it's waiting in the silence where the algorithm doesn't have a signal. And somehow we just got to figure out how to find it again without all the damn noise. All right. That's all I've got today. As always, thanks for listening.